After a lifetime of researching the dynamic and enigmatic world of light entertainment, I've decided to ditch my notebook and meet the people who inspire me. What makes them the people they are? How do they feel about the show business landscape in which they find themselves? And in a world where anyone can be a star, is there still a need for performers who have universal appeal? Come with me on a journey of discovery as I get a unique insight into Britain's favourite stars with a little help from my glamorous assistants. Yeah, well, I say glamorous, more like hazardous. And of course, we'll have a bit of fun along the way.
Since graduating from the Trinity College of Music and Drama in 1979, Mike Dixon has built up one of the most varied careers in entertainment. First working on the 1980s nationwide tour of Joseph and his amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. By the end of the decade, Mike was put forward as musical director on the 1989 Raw Variety performance, a role in which he is honoured many times. Throughout the 90s, he became a MD on a number of light entertainment shows for LWT, including An Audience With and The Shane Ritchie Experience, to name but a few. Then in 2005, Mike began a five-year stint as musical arranger to Dame Shirley Bassey, which climaxed him in gracing the Pyramid Stage at the Glastonbury Festival in 2007. After Shirley Bassey, Mike returned to his first love, musical theatre, when he provided the music to the stage production of Mrs. Henderson Presents. I caught up with the West End maestro to talk theatre, television, and of course music. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Mike Dixon. Okay, so you graduated from Trinity College of Music and Drama in 1979. Nowadays, music and drama courses are a staple of most universities, but what made you opt to do something which would have been so revolutionary at its time?
Well, I left Trinity College of, it was only Trinity College of Music when I was there, and my course was from 1975 to 1979. And whilst I was there, I was also working for the London College of Dance and Drama and playing for dance classes. And I was also working with a group called the Fulham Music Theatre. And they were doing Amdram productions, Amdram shows. But I was working brilliantly with one of the directors at English National Opera, because he was one of their directors. I got introduced to an amazing singing teacher called Ian Adam. And Ian Adam was teaching all sorts of extraordinary people like Michael Crawford, Terence Stamp, bizarrely, was going there for singing lessons, all sorts of amazing people, lots of West End Wendy's and West End Lovelies as well. But I got to play for Ian Adam whilst I was at college, and at the end, just as I was leaving college as well, which got me to know a lot of these strange and weird and wonderful actors and actresses, and made me realise that actually I could work with those kind of people. They're okay, I can deal with that. So Trinity was great in so many ways, because it gave me a good grounding in the classical side of stuff, but I also had a fantastic piano teacher who allowed me to experiment and do sort of the more jazzy, rocky, poppy sort of stuff, and was encouraging me to do other things, you know, things other than the normal trying to play Chopin and things like that. So I was totally encouraged to go down this other sort of what we used to call light music back in the day, light music route. And it's just given me such a good overall grounding. I had a great teacher at school as well, a guy called Trev Farrow, who was totally eclectic in his musical taste. So all through my life, I've been encouraged to take every single type of music that you possibly can. And it's been so good, because it means that I can stand up in front of an orchestra and conduct a jazzy something, or I can stand up and conduct Nimrod, you know. So it's just been such a great grounding all the way through. That was a really long answer to that question.
That's all right. Excellent. Okay, in 1989, you made your debut as musical production crew on the Royal Variety Performance. Since then, you've been musical director on numerous occasions. How significant has this been in shaping the rest of your career?
Well, I think it was interesting. 1989, I was doing a show called Aspects of Love for Andrew Lloyd Webber, and I was musical director for that show. And I got a phone call to say, we're doing like a 20-minute segment of Andrew's stuff for the Raw Variety Show, and Andrew would like you to be his representative, you know, there to make sure that musically everything works okay. So I went along. It was back in the days when the Raw Variety was always at the Palladium. And I had already been to the Palladium because I'd already been associate conductor of a show called La Cage aux Folles, which ran at the Palladium back in 87, something like 86, 87. And was a big successful show that came over from Broadway. So I knew lots of people at the Palladium. So when I walked into the Palladium, I recognised people, you know, backstage that I knew, chatted to them, got introduced to the BBC people. No, it was ITV. The ITV people that I needed to sort of, you know, speak with. I'd already spoken to the great and wonderful Alan Ainsworth, who was the musical director for so many Raw Varieties over the years. I mean, hundreds and hundreds. And he was musical director for the whole of the 1989 one. In fact, he conducted that the segment, and I was having to sort of talk him through how, you know, how certain parts of our little 15 minutes were going to go. So that was quite interesting. I was, you know, in homage to the great Alan Ainsworth. Anyway, that whole event sort of got me. It was lovely to just be part of this extraordinary show. You know, that for years and years growing up was one of the sort of staple main TV shows every year. You know, and there I am, you know, with a little credit on the, you know, Andrew Lloyd Webber segment, musical supervisor Mike Dixon. It was like, wow, that's me. Anyway, 2 years later, I was asked by the same group of people to be sort of number two music person on the show. And I was a musical associate on that one. And I did a couple of the charts. I did Beverly Craven sang Promise Me, so I did that. I rehearsed all the stuff with Eric Idle, and when he sang A Bright Side of Life, Always Look on the Bright Side of Life, and we had hundreds and hundreds of people on stage for that whole segment, including the Dagenham Girl Pipers, the Tiller Girls, some sumo wrestlers. It's just complete madness. It was one of those extraordinary things. Anyway, yeah, I rehearsed that, which was amazing. And then for the show itself, and this is sometimes with the Royal, mostly with the Royal, the band is just in the pit. The orchestra's in the pit. On this particular one, the orchestra, because we were at the Victoria Palace in 91, the orchestra was underneath the stage and not visible to the audience in any way, shape or form. So a man called John Cameron was the musical director and conducting that. So I was kind of working with him. But he had no direct communication to the stage. So it was all done remotely, all done via television cameras and microphones and all that sort of thing. The full orchestra was there in front of him and the backing vocalist too. And I'd done some rehearsing with some of the people on stage, and I was also sort of liaising with the stage. If John couldn't hear anything, then I was having to dash, you know, round, and I was much younger then, so I could dash. And it was really fascinating, because the other thing that I did was I made sure that I stood near where John was as much as possible, but I also had full-on open cans from the truck. In other words, I had the director and all the people in the control room on open, so I could hear everything that they were saying in the control room. So I was kind, it was that thing of trying to be a half step ahead, so you know what's coming up in a very tight rehearsal schedule, in which is what the Royal Variety tends to be. It's all done over 2 days, you know, bosh. You have a band call on the one morning, the afternoon, you start rehearsing some of the turns, and you work through the evening. The next day, it's another rehearsal in the morning, then a dress rehearsal in the afternoon, and then the show.
And that's
it. It's like
just
mad.
2 days.
Yeah, yeah, bosh.
Wow.
Done. Well, that's what it frequently has been. I mean, it's really, really high energy and high stress, you know, sort of scenario. Anyway, again, this is a very long answer to a short question, but that I'm sure you don't mind. So basically, I stood beside John, heard everything that was going on. I could hear the director talking. I could hear the producers talking. I knew what was happening. Then 2 years later, when it went back to ITV, I think I'd already done some other bits and bobs for ITV or LWT. It was London Weekend Television. By that point, and I got asked to do the whole show, the whole of the Royal Variety. And that particular year, 93, was the year when I was actually MD in Greece at the time as well. So it was at the Dominion Theatre, and we had Brian Connolly on it. It was the famous one where Michael Barrymore did the routine with the soldiers. And I can never remember the name of the song that he did, but he did a full-on routine with the soldiers having to mouth, you know, doing a marching up and down thing and holding guns and I can't remember the name of the song. Never mind. Moving on. We had for rehearsals for that part of the show, the rehearsals actually were quite funny because we were in the old Oval ITV rehearsal studios, and we had Michael and the choreographer Alan Harding and me, and I'm shouting to these soldiers, all carrying their full-on kit. I'm shouting to them to sort of mouth words, because there's a couple of places where they have to mouth words. And Alan is the choreographer, is shouting at them to march this way and march that way and march the other way. And Barrymore, brilliantly, is just trying to work out how he's going to get in between everybody and make it funny and sing the song, you know. It was a very, very interesting little bit of an afternoon of rehearsals, I suppose. Because we do back in those days, you used to do maybe a couple of weeks of rehearsals with the dancers and things. So we had a little bit of time to actually rehearse that. But that one, now this talking going back to the 1991, where the orchestra was completely under the stage and no communication at all, nobody could see the orchestra. This one, the orchestra was up on a raised platform at the back of the stage, except the raised platform, which was part of the set for Greece, could only take 16 players. So I had to be up there and I had the rhythm section, so that's drums, bass, guitar, piano, up there. And I had some of the saxophone and trumpet and trombone section. In fact, I think I had all of them, which meant that I had strings and harp and percussion and all the backing vocalists, and they had to go somewhere else in the building. So the singers were downstairs in a basement room. Okay, so that was eight backing vocalists downstairs in a separate room. The whole string section, harpist, percussion, were upstairs on the third floor at the Dominion Theatre in another room. So imagine the nightmare of the sound people trying to fuse all that together, but also us and me getting information from the director and then having to communicate, prep three buttons to talk to the whole orchestra and get everybody to know what was going on. And you're being shouted at to move things on. So it's quite a high, you know, high stressy sort of thing. It was really fun. I always love that sort of being thrown to the wolves thing, and it was exciting and great fun ultimately. So there's one story that is worth recounting. The Queen is normally very, very punctual, and she's normally to the letter. It's like we know that we need to get the national anthem ready because the Queen's arrived. She's exactly on time. Interval in the interval of the show proper, the show as recorded, so this is not when the show is shown on the television, you don't know where the interval has been because the show just runs as one whole show. But as an event, the show is in two halves, like a normal theatrical event. So there is a 20-minute interval. So in that 20-minute interval, I had some pre-recorded music that I had to record to go that was going to be used to go under some bits of video later when it was edited. So slightly complicated, but that was the only time that the Musicians Union would allow us to actually record that music. So I had about 5-10 minutes of music to record. So it was a case of, okay, we're ready to record, and 3, 2, 1, here's the first part, and you have one go at it. So you record one bit. One of them was a little bit longer, so recorded that, got to the end of this little recording session, thinking, right, I've got 10 minutes before the Queen's coming back for Act 2. Okay, 10 minutes. So I pressed the buttons, talked to the whole orchestra, okay, so that's all that recording done. We have 10 minutes. Back on the stand in 10 minutes. No more than 10 minutes. Back up. I unpressed the buttons, and in my ear, from the directors, from the Queen's coming back early. Queen's coming back early. What? Sorry, press the buttons again. Any of you who haven't gone yet? Queen's coming back early. We need to go. Sorry, apologies, but we have to go. So in front of me, I had piano, bass and drums. They hadn't had time to leave, so they were there. And basically, I recorded the on-track for Act 2, the little bit of music to bring everybody on for Act 2, with piano, bass and drums, and I think there was one trumpet or something, and that was it. So and then, fortunately, we then went into a section from a musical called Forever Plaid, which didn't involve our orchestra. So we just had to play that one little entr'acte, and then there was a bit of space when everybody outside who'd managed to get off the truck or managed to get down from upstairs realized that I had been calling them back. So they were frantically trying to come back. After the event, Nigel Lithgow was the director on this particular show. Nigel was the one who'd been calling people back, or let us know that the Queen was coming back. I saw him afterwards, because we had a little confab afterwards, and then there's usually a bit of a do and a dinner and all that sort of thing. And I saw him after, and I told him my side of the story and how that was, you know, I was so embarrassed, and I hope the entree. He said, "Oh, don't worry about that." He said, "It's even worse than that." He said, "I'd let the most of the cameras go, so we didn't actually film the first 5 minutes of the start of the second half. We didn't even film it. So they used for the show, for the actual transmission." They used for like 5 minutes. They used what was pre-recorded in the dress rehearsal. So it was the only thing they could do because they didn't have the cameras. He said Nigel was outside having a fag. You know, it's everybody's interval, and the Queen decided to come back early. So that was a good one. That was also the year when Brian Connolly, dear Brian, was told that he wanted to make an entrance on this band truck, and the band truck was supposed to then come down onto the floor because it was on a big cantilever thing. Anyway, Brian was told that we can only have so many people on this truck; can't have any more than that, otherwise the truck will stop working. It will just stop. So we'd done the rehearsal with, and it was okay. There weren't too many people on. How was it? I think it was the first rehearsal was fine. Second rehearsal, the dress rehearsal, basically, we'd had to add one more musician, or Brian had put somebody else up there on stage with him, up on this truck. They went to move the truck and it stopped. it had reached its sort of safety limit. So Brian had to make a different entrance. The show, the truck never got revealed for the show proper, and we never, you know, it just didn't happen. But sometimes, you know, something goes wrong, and you have to make the best of it. Yeah. You have to make the best of it. So yeah, so Brian, dear Brian, was the one who stopped us from having a band truck that day. Yeah. And Cilla Black was the host. Yeah, Cilla Black was the host. And we sang You'll Never Walk Alone at the end. And then after I'd done that one in 93, I think they had a few years then where they decided, after all this thing of having the orchestra in so many places, they decided to use pre-recorded music. So there were a couple of years of pre-recorded music. And I didn't get asked to do it again until 2005. And I did
That's quite a long period.
Yeah, yeah. So I was doing other things, you know, and getting involved in other things. But I had 93 to 2005 off. And then I did 2005, 2007, 2009. And I had a little bit to do with 2011, or was it 2013? I can't remember. But basically, that's my Royal Variety.
Wow. Thank you. Okay, you've recently told the Stage magazine that your job is 40% music and 60% diplomacy. What do you mean by that?
I still think that's probably right. It's about the communication with the artists that you're working with. You've got to try and make those people feel as confident as possible in what they're about to do. So you've got to be able to handle some quite big stars. You've got to handle people on the way up, you've got to handle people on the way down, you've got to handle people who are in a very stressed situation. Even though you might be stressed yourself, you can't show that. You know, one of the most important things to do is to give an air of everything's okay. Everything's okay. And it's a bit like, you know how when you see a duck on water and it, or a swan on water and it's looking very serene, but underneath its legs are going like this. As a musical director, that's kind of what you have to be at times, because you have to be able to be really personable and gentle and nice and calming and relaxing. But inside, your heart is going, you know, going completely... Because you know that there's only this limited amount of time to get this done in. And then you come to the show, and the show is quite a stressful thing, and there's 55 million things going on. But you just know that you've got to keep that. So I suppose that's the 60% diplomacy is the communication skills.
Would you say it's harder working with bigger stars than up-and-comers, or...?
Harder working with bigger stars, I don't think. I think it's any situation where there's a lot of stress, people will react in strange... You know, sometimes they'll feel like they're cornered. So you have to try and make them feel like they're as welcome and as able to do the job as possible. And I don't think it's a matter of big or little stars. I think in that situation, everybody, especially in a Royal Variety type situation, everybody has, I mean, they all have different types of nerves and they all have different types of ways of showing their nerves, but everybody's going to feel on a heightened plane because of the nature of the event. So it's just being able to deal with that.
Okay, last year you teamed up with director Andrew Keats to campaign for the UK's first Musical Direction Award. What made you feel so passionate about it?
I think over the years, what I've noticed with both the Olivier's and the What's on Stage Awards is that there's a lot of people have no real understanding of the job that a musical director or a musical supervisor actually does. So you can see somebody waving their arms around or playing the piano and waving their arms around, but you don't have any knowledge of what has gone before. That a choreographer, you might well be able to see that choreographer working with the dancers, and you can see the result of his or her work with those dancers in how the choreography is put together. You can hear what a musical director has done, because you can hear how well the orchestra sounds, and you can hear how well how good the singing is. But there has never, or for so many years, there was never any recognition in the theatre industry of what goes into being that musical director. And I wanted to just to sort of put my nose above the parapet to go, actually, we should be, if we're going to go give awards to sound designers, set designers, lighting designers, and the choreographers and the directors, then there's one person that's very, very important in that group of people that's missing, and that's the musical director. Yes, we acknowledge that there's a composer frequently and a lyric writer, but in musical theatre, the music is then altered and changed and made into something else by what the musical director and the musical director's team, including orchestrator, will actually do to that music. And so I was trying to point out respectfully to the rest of the industry that there is an omission. And I personally, as it's my side of that industry, I felt it was quite a glaring omission. And it's funny, when I spoke to quite a few people about it, their reaction was, "What do you mean there's no award for musical director?" And you go, "Well, have a look at the Oliviers. Have you ever seen? Have a look at the list. There is no musical direction award, and there hasn't ever been." The Tonys on Broadway used to have a musical director award, stopped it. They now have an orchestrator award. What I managed to do ultimately on this sort of campaign, which I suppose has been going on for, or was going on for, 4 or 5 years really, was 2 years ago now, maybe even 3 years ago, the Oliviers, after I'd lobbied and lobbied and lobbied and had quite a few meetings, they agreed to open a new award, which is an Outstanding Achievement in Music award. It hasn't actually answered the question properly, to my mind, but at least it's a start. But another group of people who are called My Theatre Mates, and they run a new award system, they have started a musical direction award, which I'm really pleased about. And also the Off West End awards called the Offies, as of this 2016, they started a new award after I'd spoken to them, and I went and had a meeting and all the rest of it. They started a new musical director award for the Offies, they're called the Off West End Awards. And I am the patron saint of that's what they call the sponsor, if you like, of the musical director award for that. So in actual fact, in a couple of weeks' time, the winner of the award, was it last year or is it this year? It might even be 2016. I think he got the award this year, but it relates to 2016. A guy called Jordan Lee. I'm meeting him. In fact, he's coming to some rehearsals that I'm doing for Radio 2. So as patron saint, he's won the award, so I want to show him what things go on, you know. So that's kind of why I over the years, I mean, some people have given me a bit of a hard time, and I had a couple of very unpleasant letters from the people who were running the What's on Stage Awards. In fact, they even blocked me on Twitter for a while, because of this whole business with the Musical Director Award, which was all a bit unpleasant. But some people were, they accused me of it's all about me getting an award, which is completely, it's not about me getting the award. It's about people who are in the same position having the opportunity to get that little gong from in the industry where And it's like, well, what is it? One of the great lines was, so what is it about musical? If you take the music out of musicals, what do you get? ALS, that's what you get, don't you? You get ALS, yeah. So you get ALS. That's all you get. Take the music out of musicals, that's all you get. So it's like, I think it was quite interesting. People just had no idea that there was this omission.
I can't believe there hasn't been an award for it. Mm. When you think about it, the work that goes into it in film, television, theatre.
Yeah, well, film and television was slightly different because on the Oscars there was a best music for a movie, mm-hmm. so the composer of the best music would get an award, and there's still a best song, so there is that,
but no musical direction.
But no musical. No. But then again, in movies, there's a director award, and the director kind of takes the whole thing for, I think, in a way, kind of less worried about it for the Oscars. It's, I mean, I know nowadays there are more musicals in film, but it's basically about the fact that there's a whole genre in theatre that is referred to as musical theatre, and the linchpin of musical theatre is the musical director working with the director, choreographer, on the, you know, the whole show. Anyway, that was my thing.
Great.
That was another short answer, wasn't it? Sorry.
In 2015, you directed the Christmas special of BBC Radio 2's Friday Night is Music Night. How different is it doing the Christmas special, Christmas edition, compared to the regular edition?
A Christmas Radio 2 Friday Night is Music Night is fun. And the one that I did in 2015 was with Michael Xavier and Sam Estrallan, singing a few Christmas tunes. I suppose that there's a little bit of letting hair down on the Christmas special because you know you have a bit of tinsel and everybody likes a Christmas song, everybody likes a Christmas carol, don't they? So I know we had. We did have a nice time putting that little show together. A great thing about all those Friday Night is Music Nights is it's a little bit like a Royal Variety Show sometimes, where you've got a whole group of people to sort of fit in and slot in very quickly. But it's a one-off event, and it only ever happens once. You might get it, you know, you might be able to see it or hear it again, but essentially it's a one-off performance. And that's quite an attractive proposition. That's challenging, but also quite attractive. And there have been quite a few of those type events that I've done where the only time we've actually done a complete run through is the recording. Because even the dress rehearsal, you've not done everything. Because there hasn't been time to go through absolutely everything. So the only time you go through the whole thing. So D-Day, the D-Day thing we did at the Albert Hall, 70 years since D-Day, we had various actors reading things and Patrick Stewart and all sorts of amazing people reading. Patrick was actually reading stuff that Winston Churchill had said. We'd had enough time, we'd rehearsed all the music, and I had to time some of the music to how they were speaking things. But in the afternoon, we'd had quite a few problems with the sound scenario, so things are backed up and we just hadn't had time. So that show, which was filmed as well as recorded, went out on BBC Red Button as well as the radio. That show only ever existed on that very... We hadn't had time to go through everything. So quite a lot, about a third of the show was complete winging it from everybody, where I was listening to what the actors were saying. They hadn't had time to, just hadn't been time to go through everything. So that's a one-off event. Excellent. Proper. Scary.
Thank you, Davey. Without wanting to sound like the great Parky interviewing Tarvac, we have a mutual friend who also works on Friday Night is Music Night. Do you ever find yourself working with the great Colin Edmonds.
The great Colin Edmonds. What a lovely, lovely man. Colin and I have had the fortune to work together on a couple of ITV things over the years. And I think our paths have crossed on Friday Night Is Music Night a couple of times, but not enough, because I really like Colin, and he's such a lovely writer and such a witty, warm and lovely man to have around. And he writes exactly how whoever it is he's you know giving the words to, he writes as if he's them. Some people write and it's like, right, this is the best thing you've got to say. Say this, you know, say this. Colin writes very much to, he cuts his cloth exactly to the people that he's working with, and he's always been brilliant at that. He's also a very good novelist, and I think his second novel is shortly out. His first book, I think it's called Steam, Smoke and Mirrors. I should know. I've read it. I've got it on my iPhone. Anyway, his second book is coming out, and it's part of his steampunk. Colin is somebody you look at, and you would never in a million years think that he would write in the genre steampunk. You know, he looks like just a regular guy, you know, wearing cardigans. You know, he just doesn't look like a steampunk connoisseur. And there he is, extraordinary.
Excellent. Okay, for this, you worked with the legendary producer Alan Boyd. Can you give us an insight into working with a legend of the industry?
Alan Boyd, old Boydie. Alan did Friday Night for a long time and then became Wogan's right-hand man for many, many years, and on Wogan's radio show. And Alan is a past master at putting together two or three singers, putting together an hour and a half show that has a real flow, different styles of music. Every show that he would put together, the music would, he wouldn't use the same thing. It would all be different. But he was always able to make put a stamp, an Alan Boyd stamp on a Friday Night Is Music Night. He was just really clever at doing that. He also could probably drink anybody that I know under the table. It's absolutely extraordinary. Extraordinary. And you might bump into him if you're wandering around Broadcasting House late on a Wednesday afternoon or something. You might find him in a little Italian restaurant quaffing a nice bottle of Chianti or something. But an absolute legend and a lovely, lovely man.
Okay. Last year you finished a mammoth stint on the hit musical Mrs. Henderson Presents. I suppose parts of the story resonates with your career. How did you feel when it came to an end?
Well, Mrs. Henderson Presents was a bit of a labour of love, beautifully written, new musical based on the Windmill Theatre and all that the Windmill Theatre was about. Mrs. Henderson basically ran the Windmill Theatre, bought the Windmill Theatre, and this extraordinary man, Vivian Van Damme, then put together these sets of shows. We did a show based on the movie from 2006. George Fenton and Simon Chamberlain wrote the music. Terry Johnson wrote the book, all based on that movie, which was in turn based on the reality. And it was such a lovely show to put together. You know, one of the things that you have to address is the fact that the Windmill was about having naked ladies on stage, and the whole premise of it was the end of the 30s when Mrs. Henderson went to the Lord Chamberlain and said that this is what she wanted to do, and he said it cannot be, you can't put nude women on stage, cannot possibly be in this, and she got him to agree that if they stood still and were like statues, it would be like going to the National Gallery, be the same as going to the National Gallery. They would be standing as still as statues. Famously, then, in the war, in the Second World War, it became the go-to place because all the guys would come back from being, you know, on the front or whatever, and the place they'd want to go would be the Windmill Theatre because they'd have a few laughs from a few comics and a bit of this, you know, and some jokes and all that, and then they'd get to see some naked girlies as well. So it was hugely, and they used to do things like, and it's true that this did happen. They'd occasionally secrete a mouse, you know, and throw a mouse up on the stage and see what happened then. Because if the girls jumped and ran around, you know, they'd get in all sorts of trouble. But it would be good because then you get to see, you know, a little bit more, shall we say, in the nicest way. Anyway, the Wimmer was fascinating for so many reasons. There's a lovely little story. My wife, her godmother's husband, now in his 90s, when we said, Natalie actually said that I was doing this show and it was all about the windmill, he said, it just suddenly his head went into an extraordinary place. He went, the windmill, he said, all the way. I was 14 through the, or 15 or whatever it was, through the, at the big, when it became the Windmill Theatre, and it was my ambition to go. It was, yeah, because it was the only time you didn't see. There was no Page Three in the Sun. There was no, you know, Top Shelf. There was none of that. That was like the only place you could see naked women, naked flesh. And he's, and my wife, Natalie, said, so did you manage to go then? Oh, yes, I did. Oh, yes. And it's still one of the highlights of my life going there. You know, so this is a man now in his late 80s, early 90s, yeah, going absolutely. going on about the windmill. And some of the girls who were still there when the Windmill Theatre itself closed, and some of the girls who were there in the 50s actually came to our show to see our actors and our people doing it, and it was great. So Mrs. Henderson, it was great fun to put on, great fun to be involved with her, you know, and I always like doing new, I've been lucky, I always seem to do new musicals, this has just come from Broadway or blah, blah, blah. Doing a show from the very beginning is always the best way. And you know, Mrs. Henderson, it's one of those shows where it had critical acclaim, but didn't quite grab the attention of the public. So it didn't last as long as it should have done. But it's a good little piece, really good little British musical.
Okay. In the 1990s, saw a surprise reemergence of the great light entertainment shows of the 60s and the 70s, thanks to ITV's An Audience With. You became musical director on a number of these shows. What do you think is the secret to its success?
An Audience With. I'm very lucky. I did 4 or 5 of those over the. I did Jimmy Tarbuck's. I did Joan Rivers. I did Shirley's. Maybe I did 3. Did I do another one? Doesn't matter. Whatever I did a few. I did a few Audience With. But Shirley Bassey's was the first. No, Shirley Bassey's was not the first one I did. I did the Jimmy Tarbuck one a few years before. And for Jimmy's, he had a band that he wanted to play Johnny B. Goode. And the band that we booked was Rick Wakeman on keyboards, John Lord from the Moody Blues on bass, Hank Marvin on guitar, and I think it was Kenny, how was it on drums? From the New Faces, the drummer from the New Faces. And I was musical director. So basically I had a load of rock legends to go and say, right, are you doing Johnny B. Goode? He wants to sing it in this key. Off you go. Sing, yeah, play Johnny B. Goode. So that's kind of what happened. That was a bit of a weird one with a load of, you know, amazing rock legends. But the Shirley Bassey one was really good. It was the second one that she'd done. And there was one little moment where there was an earring that kept falling off, and we kept on having to stop because this earring fell off and the continuity was then completely buggered up. And in the end, I think we because she tried this song three times, and every time she did some shake of the head and the earring went, I think they either taped it on or we just carried on and you know, it was all right. The Joan Rivers one was quite bizarre because she just basically we played her on, and then she referred to us a couple of times and made a joke about the fact that we were playing in front of a mirror because it made us look like we were double the size. You know, not personally. I mean, that's the band double the size, you know, so look like more players. And then basically told as many jokes as... I mean, she was amazing. She was told not to use the F word. I do remember that. She was told not... Now, don't use the F word until at least, I think it was 5 minutes into the show. Don't use the F word. So to be fair, I don't think she did use the F word, but she used the C word within the first 2 minutes. Oh dear. But an audience with is such a great opportunity for one artist to really show what they can do. I've just remembered another one that I did, Lionel Richie. We did a one-off special, a live one for Lionel Richie, which was quite exciting. So live band on stage, went out. Normally they're recorded. This one was a live one. So Lionel was the questions and all the rest of it had no chance to be edited. It possibly would have been better if it had been edited because it needs to be tightened up. But it was a good thing to do. But I think it's a great exhibition for an artist to show how they. Well, you know, some of it is, you know, manufactured to the questions, but frequently they'll expose something that they weren't necessarily intending to expose. They'll let something slip that just shows them to be as frail as anybody else. Just occasionally. I mean, Kenneth, there was a fantastic audience with Kenneth Williams, where he was on tip top. Absolutely unbelievable form, and I think that gave him it was I remember that one distinctly. I sadly wasn't on it, but I remember it distinctly being so illuminating as to really how the man was, even though it was about him performing and he was performing there. It showed a couple of little moments of just a chink through the armor, which was really good. But I think the concept of an audience with is such a good idea. And I don't think they're doing it anymore, but you never know, it might come back.
Apart from being a light entertainment musical director, you've also written a number of TV theme tunes. What is the secret to a successful theme tune?
Oh, I wish I'd had a really successful theme tune. I've done a few Royal Variety theme tunes. Did Brian Connolly series? There was a point where I think I did a comedy awards as well, a British Comedy Awards set of themes as well. But I always find the best thing to do with a theme is to imagine the tune based on the title. So, for example, and I didn't write this, but if you think of the cop series, The Sweeney, that theme tune goes ba-da-da, ba-da-da. So it goes, The Sweeney, The Sweeney. And it just helps in identifying the title of the show. Royal Variety Show is quite difficult in that respect because it's a bit of a mouthful. So I think I think a couple of the tunes I did for Royal Variety Shows were just kind of generic, just a the idea of that tune is to give a real idea of what the show's going to be. So it's light, it's bubbly, it's sing-along-y, that kind of thing, I suppose. It's difficult to say. Because, I mean, you know, the greatest of all the theme tune writers is probably Tony Hatch. And Tony Hatch is, you know, from Neighbours right through to Crossroads, you know, with hundreds and hundreds of shows in between. Absolutely amazing.
In recent years, television entertainment has changed dramatically. The infamous BBC Television Centre closed its doors in 2013. BBC Broadcasting House is now being used to house programmes like The One Show, with the rest of the BBC has fled to Salford. Reflecting upon your light entertainment work during the 90s, what impact has the closure of Television Centre had on the output of British entertainment?
Dear old Television Centre, that iconic building in White City, with that big circular building and all the studios around the outside of those sets of offices. TC1, which is the big studio, Television Centre 1. All the studios had just had the TC on the front. I wonder why. What a good idea that is. TC1, TC2. Where's that going to be then? Oh, it could be Television Centre. Anyway, Television Centre, all sorts of things were filmed there over the through the 60s and 70s, including, you know, Doctor Who's, loads of light entertainment shows, hundreds upon hundreds of shows, and amazing people went through the doors of Television Centre. And it is so sad that they finally decided to close it down in 2013. I believe they've opened, or they're opening, a part of it as a sort of bit of legacy. The rest of it, I think they're going to make into, or have made into, flats, apartments. But it, I suppose there is an argument to say it's, you know, a sign of the times that things have to move on, and that sort of having a huge hub area where everything happens is no longer viable. But I just wonder if the BBC has sort of scored an own goal by doing that, and everything, you know, the Salford thing, centre, which is lovely, and there's some great things up there, recording the One Show at Broadcasting House, the old radio building with its new bit, and then of course the EastEnders and Strictly Come Dancing, which are filmed at Elstree, BBC Elstree. I mean, if Strictly was happening in the 70s, Strictly would have been in TC1, in that huge, lovely studio, TC1. I did manage to work there a few times. And what was great about Television Centre was that you'd go from your rehearsal in your studio, and you'd walk around this circular area outside, and you'd bump into, you know, somebody recording a game show, somebody else recording a drama, other people. You bump into all sorts of extraordinary people. So allied to TV Centre was this amazing rehearsal room at Queen's Park. And if you do a rehearsal there, then you go down to Television Centre. And I remember being up at the Queen's Park rehearsal rooms, and I can't remember what I was rehearsing, but walking down a corridor and into a lift with Lena Zavaroni and Ernie Wise. Where else could that possibly happen? Nowhere else in the world. Extraordinary.
Okay, you also run masterclasses for potential musicians. In your opinion, how important do you see this role in ensuring the future of musical entertainment?
I think there's a really good group of young musical directors now, sort of in the ascendancy coming up. Not many have had the opportunity of working in television yet. There are a lot of I was talking earlier about these Offies awards and this there are two or three of these young up and coming musical directors, one of whom, actually not the one who won this year, but the one who I saw last year working on something. I've managed to suggest him for a show that I'm involved in, which is Greece. And Greece is now out on tour. And this lovely, lovely young chap is assistant musical director on this tour of Greece. So Josh, his name, Josh Snood. And he's one of this sort of group of young up-and-coming people. I think it's humongously important that we don't just get used to playing backtracks. It's humongously important that we have a situation where, even if it's just a four-piece band, I mean, if it can be a 40-piece, how brilliant, because it's going to sound better if it's 40 players than if it's four players. But if it can only be four players, at least make it four players and not a tape recorder or not a digital whatever. At least try and make music go along with the flow of the flow of the action in the show. At least make it, rather than it just stagnates as being this is the recorded music. It can't change. It has to be exactly the same every night. It has to, you know, and in a light entertainment scenario, you will get a different reaction from a singer or group of singers working with a live band than if they're just standing there with a backing track. They'll vibe off the live band. You only have to watch, you know, something like the Jules Holland show and just see how people get off on really playing along with and singing with a big old live band.
Okay, and what's next for Mike Dixon?
Well, I've just finished doing a very, very big job. I've just finished being music director, slightly different title, music director, as opposed to musical director, for the opening and closing ceremonies for the fourth Islamic Solidarity Games. So I've, over the last 15 months, I've been working on with a completely international team, an Australian artistic director, an American choreographer, a Greek designer, an English designer, British producers, Mexicans, Italians, hundreds of amazing, extraordinary, creative people, making these two huge ceremonies that happened in Baku back in May 2017. And we're obviously televised in the Islamic world. But big events, you know, a little bit like doing you know, the Olympic opening ceremony. That kind of scale of event with thousands of people on stage and lots of different segments. You know, you have an artistic brief to tell a particular story. So I've just finished doing that. And right now I'm in the middle of some concerts. I'm doing the 50th anniversary since the repeal of the homosexual law in 1967. So there is a celebration up in the City of Culture, Hull, on July the 29th, and various people are singing, and we've got a small band, and I'm playing along. I'm a musical director for that. We're doing some fun things. I think Mark Arman's singing, Alison Moyet, Will Young, wonderful Tom Robinson from who does 2468 Motorway and the anthem Glad to Be Gay. So I'm doing that. It's great. And then I go to Holland for a few days to do some gigs, and then I've got Miss World in China in October, November.
Ah, very busy. Yeah, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much to our guests for being the subject to another Beyond the Title interview. If you like this, why not browse the website and see if there's anything that takes your fancy? Don't forget to like our Facebook page to receive updates on forthcoming interviews and to see more information about me and what I do. Thanks again, and hopefully see you next time for another Beyond the Title interview.